Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of my new podcast, Working Class Cinema. In this series, we will aim to study many aspects of working class life on film, both in front and behind the camera, and all over the world during all time periods. My name is John. I'm a trade unionist, an occasional activist, and a film fan. I hope you enjoy the show, but I must note here that the new episodes, at least in the foreseeable future, will not be that frequent. I work full-time and I have other commitments, including other broadcasting projects, but I will make as many of these as I can and as often as possible. What you're listening to now is probably going to be the first series, the first episode of the first series, and I haven't quite worked out how I'm going to do all those things yet, because really I'm just excited to get on with making a podcast about working-class cinema. So we'll work all of that out some other time. I also aim to get guests on to discuss various things, so this is not just my voice and opinions all of the time. If there is anything that you think would make an interesting feature for an episode, a specific film, a specific actor, director, writer, or even a region of the world, let me know. Anything you can let me know about how I can gain access to such films too would be greatly appreciated. And as far as contact is concerned, wait till the end of the episode and I'll tell you a little bit more about that then. Now, before we go on, I'd like to thank some people. Julie V, David RB, Stacey Clare, Dan Glass, Saeed Taji Faruqi, and my dad, all of whom have influenced this podcast one way or other with conversations, recommendations, and access to films. In some cases, access to films back in the day when I was unemployed and had no money of my own. So thanks, Dad. Just to let you know up front, the show will contain some adult content. In the discussion. Also, at one point, I will be referring to the WGA strike. That is, of course, the Writers Guild of America. Now, I'm recording this in late July of 2023, so the Writers Guild of America is still on strike, and I've been joined for separate but united reasons by SAG-AFTRA as well, which, of course, is the Screen Actors Guild, etc. Interesting times. Maybe that would actually be, well, that would make a great episode. Let's see how that one plays out. But in the meantime, you're listening to episode one of Working Class Cinema, where we're going to talk about The Wrestler and CAM. That is the body as entertainment. So let's get into it. Now, in this opening episode of Working Class Cinema, we discuss two films and not only feature working class characters throughout, but look specifically at those who use their bodies for the entertainment of others. Both films are also distinguished for their lack of judgment towards sex workers, which is more the social norm these days, I'm glad to say, but not something culture has caught up with quite yet in many instances. It's still being argued about, shall we say. So the first film we're going to talk about is The Wrestler, the 2008 US film directed by Darren Aronofsky and starring Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei. Now, most of you will probably know this film, if you know it at all, as being specifically well remembered for a great comeback for Mickey Rourke, also to some degree a comeback for Marissa Tomei. She was out of the game for a while, more by choice than Mr. Rourke's reasons, but nevertheless it's an interesting piece of work. Now, I do not want to run through every part of the plot of this film, that's not what I'm here for, but instead I want to focus on some specific aspects, mainly the focus on working class lives in non-traditional settings, but also the specifics of how the film portrays the work done by these characters and does not judge the choices made, especially towards Marissa Tomei's character Cassidy, who's also known as Pam. So Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler plays Randy the Ram, and his relationship with Cassidy is based to begin with on transaction. He is her customer. They become friends later on and stumble across the lines of acceptability, as that's just basically part of the plot, you know, part of the storyline. But this is less what interests me here, so I won't go into that too much. What I do like about Marissa Tomei's character, who is Cassidy, who is a stripper, i.e. she is a sex worker. She is not, however, susceptible to most of the typical cliches and tropes that are normally attached to sex workers in films, particularly American films. Her character is not tragic. She is not a drug addict. She has not been forced by anything other than the same circumstances all working class people face to perform in this job or any other job for that matter. And most of all, the film does not shame her. She is not mocked in the film. And she even gets to live at the end, which is a rarity for sex workers in films most of the time. She's not looking to be saved, nor is that an option, even if she were. That's just simply not part of the plot. She does face ageism from younger punters and has plans to do something else with her life in future. But again, something not always given to sex workers in films, which is why I think it's relevant and worth noting. So, you know, she's basically just treated like a typical working class character in any other way. She's got her trials and tribulations. She's got her joys. She's got her plans about the future. And she's very headstrong and independent. And that's a great thing to see. The parallel between her and Rourke's character of Randy is that they are united in using their bodies in order to entertain others. That's how they make their living. Their labor is literally selling access to their physical self, which is used directly in their line of work. They also sell fantasies. Randy the Ram gives you the hero for a few rounds of a wrestling match, taking the beating and coming back to win in the end. Cassidy sells you the woman who is interested in you, so basically the girlfriend experience as much as it is access to see her body. I'll give you a bit more detail about that. So this is a realistic depiction of working class life and sex work, in which it is considered as relevant as any other kind of work. Hollywood is a money-making machine, let us not forget, and they do not care about anything beyond making that money. So to see a 2008 film that presents sex work, something endlessly argued about amongst feminist circles, for instance, without judgment or resort to cliché is impressive at a basic level for sure. The recognition of sex work as legitimate work is also still contested, sadly. So this is a kind of representation that to some degree, and a very limited level, actually does mean something. Sex work is work. Now, representation is something that I won't go into too much detail here. I'd quite like to talk about it in a later show, actually. I believe that without using a cliched and reductive term, that to some degree it is what it is. And what I mean by that is it is very limited in what it's about and what it can achieve. But if you accept that for what it is on a surface level, then there's something there. And I would not minimize the fact that to some people, seeing characters who in films, in television, in whatever, who look like them and sound like them or have lived lives like them, that can actually mean something. Fine. If that means something to you, I'm not going to shit on that. I think it's perfectly good. So good for you. Anyway, back to the film, The Wrestler. There's nothing particularly glamorous about Rourke's life in wrestling, nor Tomei's. They're both presented as they are. Rourke's life is pretty grim, despite having such a history of glory. You know, he once wrestled at Madison Square Garden. There's a very interesting kind of montage at the beginning of the film where it kind of drifts around a wall that's sort of covered in posters and flyers and press cuttings for the days when Randy the Ram was a bit more of a major player. But that was 20 years ago, the film informs us. In fact, at this stage in his life, Randy is so poor that he gets locked out of his trailer home at one point and he has to sleep in his truck. There is no way for him anymore to make a living out of wrestling, so he has to work in a local supermarket. The wrestling matches he participates in get more extreme too. They're basically a weekend pursuit, but they now involve bats, pieces of wood, broken glass being smashed into his body, things like this. Anything that keeps a dwindling audience is coming. Levels of violence that cannot get extreme enough, it seems. Well, Cassidy has to use her body to interest men in paying for her private time, not just dancing on the stage, but also in the back room in the VIP section, whatever you want to call it. So she has to impress customers to some degree on a more individual basis, and as well as a collective. And so does Randy in a way. In the private realm, Cassidy sells, as I mentioned before, the girlfriend experience along with the private performance. She sits, she listens, she counsels and consoles, will perhaps weep with you, perhaps at least on a surface level, as you regale her of your trials and tribulations. This is, of course, an aspect of care work that we don't talk about enough in wider society. I mean, first of all, we don't talk about care work enough. We also don't talk about where it's done in realms that people just simply don't see. It's done by people outside of their working life. It seems predominantly done by women because of the way society is structured. And it's done by sex workers and volunteers and people down the job centre and lots of other folks who are just not really recognised, not to mention social workers who actually have a job of doing that but still struggle to be recognised. Watching this, you are reminded that most sports people are also working class. they are not rich. The ones that do rise up the ranks are usually unable to sustain long careers too. All of this reminded me of a real life incident, in fact, of the wrestler and actor and now, I don't know, presenter, activist, I don't know what you call him, Jesse Ventura, who tried to unionize in the old WWF back in the 80s. Wrestlers are one of those groups of workers in the US who are categorized as independent contractors, despite working full time for the wrestling federations that they do work for. And to the best of my knowledge, they tend to be fully contracted to those. They can't actually wrestle for another federation until they're released from that contract. So you're basically on the books, but somehow or another you're an independent contractor. Not quite sure how that works. This means, of course, in the US system of being an independent contractor, that companies can use this as a way to avoid paying health insurance, social security, unemployment compensation, all of that usual stuff. Ventura was against this precariousness, not least after he'd starred in the film Predator, and that had given him access to the Screen Actors Guild and the protections and benefits that had brought to his life. So he thought that was worth passing on to other people in the wrestling profession. So in the locker room before WrestleMania 2, Jesse encouraged the other athletes to start a union and refused to perform without access to such a union, as these athletes were all getting stiffed by Vince McMahon. The guy that ran and did he found the WWF, WWE? I don't remember. I know he runs it anyway. They were doing all the work and taking all the risks, and he was reaping shit tons of money. Ventura got grassed up doing this by Hulk Hogan, and McMahon threatened to fire him. If I remember rightly, it was not long after this that Jesse Ventura left the then WWF, now known as the WWE, while Hogan went on to get paid more than even the other wrestlers who he was fighting in the ring at that time. Famously, WrestleMania 3, according to Ventura, when he talked about this, was when Hogan got more money than Andre the Giant, and Andre the Giant was in the same ring as him. So, figure that one out. Last year, also, a few stories broke about minor league baseball in the US and how badly paid the players are. In an attempt to unionize, the players went public and discussed not getting paid, having little to no access to food unless they could find it and pay for it themselves, and having to share cheap and often low quality hotel rooms whilst out on, I call it on tour. I don't know what you call it if you're playing, you know, baseball in a different town, but yeah, it looks like a tour to me. Anyway, even when they were at home, whatever they could afford for a home, they lived in equally bad accommodation with little access to decent food. Not much in the way of nutrition, and yet these folks are supposed to be athletes, supposed to keep themselves at the best quality fitness they can. Meanwhile, here in the UK, we recently saw the England women's football team win a European tournament. An even more impressive feat, as so little funding has been put into women's sports over the years, and all the players that I believe I'm right about this. I think all the players still work outside of football as they can't afford to play full time. I don't know, that may have changed a little in the last year, but I'm pretty sure at that point that was the state of affairs. And that's particularly galling when you consider how much money is actually sloshing around in the world of football. Far too much, frankly. My opinion. Don't care if you disagree. So a good few examples there that we would do well to focus on rather than dismissing the world of sports as being nothing but rich, overprivileged babies who tend to be the ones who gain all of the media attention, but not necessarily the majority or the ones that do the most amount of work. Also worthy of note before we move on, Randy the Ram works in a supermarket under a demeaning manager who has no respect for him. So that's one you can clip off your working class bingo card right there. There'll be plenty more as this series goes on. The film also displays the dangers of nostalgia. As Randy the Ram clings to his glory days as he has absolutely nothing left in the present, by the end of the film, this is literally his only life, that due to health issues is likely to result in his death. Life has left him behind, he was not successful enough in his youth, and in an industry that we all know rinses its athletes out and throws them away as if they're nothing. As soon as they're done, as soon as their entertainment value is considered to be up. There's many a scene of him in cold and drafty looking sports halls, you know, taking photos with people and signing autographs. And actually one of the most affecting scenes in The Wrestler, I thought, was the scene where him and a bunch of other wrestlers, you know, the older kind of washed up ones, just all looking a wreck, you know, sitting in a little sports hall on a Saturday afternoon and signing autographs and taking photos, and less and less people bothering to come and see them, you know. Not many cases, some of them not even bothering to take the jackets off, you know. It's so cold. It's a really powerful scene, I thought, actually. Cassidy actually takes on the role of trying to convince Randy to give up for his own good, to save his life, effectively, which is interesting because it kind of makes her the saviour. Now, researching this film, I didn't really find any comment on the humanising and normalising of the sex workers that I've discussed here, but I also didn't find any condemnation of it either. So I'm sure somebody mentioned it in their reviews somewhere, and who knows, maybe you've got an example you can send me at some point. Okay, so that's The Wrestler, 2008. And the next film we're going to talk about is Cam, which is a film from 2018, which when I started doing this, I just want to know, I didn't realise there was 10 years difference between the two of them, but there you go. Anyway, yes, a 2018 film about an online sex worker who finds her identity has been taken away from her via some kind of algorithm that no one seems to know how it works. Alice, known on screen as Lola Lola, is a sex worker who performs at home via a webcam, which connects her to a hosting site. She gets tips and payments from customers and works to rise up the ranking system that they have on this site. While paying, she reveals at one point in the film, in her words, half of what she makes to be on the site itself. As she investigates, she finds evidence that some of the other workers on this site, including the highest rated performer, Baby Girl, are actually AI generated from images of dead people. Due to a faked suicide that Lola Lola performed on camera previously through the increasingly deranged demands of her customer base, the algorithm now thinks that she's dead and that they can use her image. So they do. There are quite a few reasons, I think, to admire this film, one of which is how sadly apt it feels now that we're discussing how AI is set to replace talent in the world of entertainment. This film presents the horrific notion of having your own life shut down via a system that no one can access because it has been built that way, something affecting employees and customers. Again, like The Wrestler, the film does not choose to make the sex worker a victim, an addict in need of saving, or in any way a villain or misguided. If anything, in the film, the customers and their increasingly twisted demands are the enemy, not the cam girls who are just trying to make a living, and clearly make a very good one if they can get enough attention. The work, like all work, certainly has its drawbacks, not least the amount of time that is needed to make an impact. These sites run all day and all night, meaning that hours can be on demand rather than there being any kind of traditional working structure. So this is gig work, basically. Alice struggles against the corporation here. Her payments to the hosting site for the privilege of using it does not, it seems, guarantee her good service, as she struggles with being shut out of her own account and having her online identity taken over, which spills over into real life at certain points. All of this being something that she appears to be able to do nothing about. All of a sudden, some of her creepy customers are showing up to meet her when this was not actually arranged, but they seem to think it was. Now, this film certainly sees the infrastructure of the online sexual entertainment industry as being driven by technology that aims to make a profit no matter what, including by literally dehumanizing the performers and replacing them with an AI-generated equivalent. I think this is where the greatest horror aspect of the story comes from, because this film is certainly portrayed as a horror film, certainly if you go and check out the trailer for it. I actually think it's pitched, the whole film is pitched somewhere between a thriller and a horror. I think it works equally well. But yeah, it's the idea of a force portrayed, I suppose, as I say, in the trailer and throughout much of the film, portrayed almost as if a kind of supernatural entity. But actually, no, it's a very, very real world one. It's just out of our reach. And I think this is, you know, where that greatest horror aspect comes in. It's an interesting comment, I think. Our protagonist is being replaced by computer generation. It is impossible for her to stop it, and she cannot even properly contact the company who are doing it. Like any corporation, they are above account or even above the law. You have to access them in order to bring them into the law, of course. I also like how they take a certain type of scene and turn it on its head in Cam. There's one of those scenes where there's a confession or discussion with a relative about the great secret of the protagonist's life, in this case, the fact that she is a sex worker. This is your classic uncomfortable scene where, after finding out what her daughter does for a living, Alice's mother sits with her discussing what to do next. However, at one point during this scene, her mother tells Alice that she's seen some of her videos and she compliments her on doing a really good job. Alice is obviously embarrassed here as part of this type of scene that you would expect, but not for the reasons you would necessarily imagine so, because rather than her mother judging her for doing this work, she's embarrassed because her mother's actually watched the videos in itself, but it's, as I said, very complimentary on her performance. It's another way that the film doesn't judge Alice for her life choices, and it's a nice little switch, I think, on a fairly often seen type of scene in films. So I like that bit. And the film also gives us a good argument for why she does the work. Alice has her own place, and she's managed to furnish it with good quality and expensive items that we see her buying on her phone. Now, that's not easy to do in modern America, much like plenty of other places. And it's certainly not very easy to do when you're doing any kind of gig work. She is, however, subject to the whims of the market, just like any of us. To grow her profile and keep up with other cam girls, Alice does have to do work that she doesn't like, such as teaming up with another girl and using a very heavy vibrator that most of her fellow sex workers discuss as potentially damaging her body, specifically the clitoris, because it is so extreme. So here we have circumstances and powers beyond your control forcing a type of undesirable work upon you. So there's another one to tick off your bingo card. This all comes after another cam girl appears to be stealing Lola's customers. The competition of workers against each other is the enemy here, but again, this is treated like any other type of work that we must do under capitalism. I also like the way the film uses the tipping and ranking system and cuts to and from it. I usually can't stand films that cut too much, but this is a rare occasion where, in these scenes specifically, it works well as giving us an idea of the rapid and distracting aspects of the job Alice does. She has to keep her focus on the camera all the time. She has to talk to the camera. She's talking directly to her customers. But at the same time, she's having to keep an eye on her rankings, having to keep an eye on the tips, on the comments, what the comments are saying, what they're asking her to do, whether or not she's going to do it or not, how popular any one thing seems. You know, if she suggests something to do, she has to watch out to see if it gets a good, you know, recall from her customers, if they like it. And she has to be aware of this at all times. You know, this is all about the effect on her customer base, which in turn has an effect on her and what she's able to do. If something's unpopular, she has to change track pretty quickly. Now, the thriller element kicks in, and we watch Alice, Lola, try to literally beat the system, having to find an elaborate way to trick it into shutting down and giving her back her life. She uses the demands of the customers for the two of them, that's her and the AI generation, to play a game of matching each other's movements until the fake Lola glitches out, and Alice is able to regain control of her identity, at least for now. So after all of this horror, you know, the kind of classic system that's trying to destroy you, etc., etc., at the end of the film, Lola goes back to work. Her mother questions this decision, as perhaps we do in the audience, but Alice lays out her options, basically taking the same course of action. If the system takes over her identity again, she will have to outsmart it again. But we don't know how she's going to do this. But Alice will carry on. She has to because she has to work, and she is good at this work. It's an interesting pitch to the ending, because one side of it sees it as if there's not so much choice there, but then it flips slightly to thinking, well, actually, no, there is a choice here. And as Alice, when she's portraying Lola, is good at this work, why should she be forced out of doing it by a corporation that thinks they're above the law? I think this film acknowledges all of this. Why else would we have a scene where her mother tells her how talented she is at camming? No doubt she could do other work, but what pays enough in America today to afford a roof over your head? So, I mean, if there's any condemnation in this film, it's more towards the customers than the actual sex workers. And, you know, I think that's a good position. So some other takes of this film say that it is about addiction to social or other types of media. And maybe there is something in that. That's a perfectly valid comment to be making in 2018, as it still is in 2023. Maybe Alice does want the world to see her, but I still think that take misses her material need, which is what I'm trying to address here. As I said, Alice needs to work, and this work pays. Whichever way you turn it around, certainly from my perspective anyway, you might disagree with my review, but the way I look at it is that's what this is about. Whichever way you look at it, there is material need. She has to work. She has to get paid. Similar in a way to the ending of 8 Mile, actually, which I've always kind of liked. Our protagonist wins the rap contest and his local, and then he goes back to work because he's got a night shift. That's what you do. You know, it's not going to change his life because he beat a few other kids in a rap contest. Yeah. Anyway, Lola knows, as we do, that the system, this corporation, cannot be beaten so easily, and she will have to continue to participate because this is her job. You beat one system, you get energized, and you take on the next one. In fact, this is our life. This is our life. This ending is why I like the film so much, above all the other reasons I've stated here. I think it's a terrific ending. What can be expected carrying on the fight is workers can gain greater power. And what this film does lack is collective action. Although the performers united could no doubt move power in this situation, maybe even getting customers involved to advocate for their rights. Naturally, I would have liked an ending where all the cam girls decide to start a union and demand the corporation give them power over their own work. But there you go, you can't have everything. That would have been an interesting ending for sure, but instead we get a more dystopian one. Alice, however, is not a victim. She may not have power by the end, but she will still fight for it. The fact is that the world she lives in, the same world that the rest of us live in, is, yes, it's grinding and it's dystopian and it's unpleasant. That's the way work has gone. That's the way we've allowed it to go. It's also great to see a film with more than a nod to a classic Hitchcock thriller, with a sex worker as a main character, which is something I reckon Hitch would have been quite proud of. Okay, so let's talk about some parallels that we haven't covered already between these two films. Both the character of Cassidy in The Wrestler and Lola Lola in Cam provide a fantasy, but not merely a sexual one. What I think both films also do really well is show the side of sex work that I mentioned earlier that involves caring. Both characters at some point are playing the supportive girlfriend type of role to their customers, which is even more explicit in Cam, actually. Imagining that you can connect with someone, which is often what punters come looking for from sex workers. Also, both films were made with authenticity in mind. The Wrestler involved real competitors and scenes filmed at real-life wrestling events and involving the cast, among others. It also involved trips to strip clubs to gain insight. Cam was written by Iza Mazzi, I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, who is a former Cam girl with much of the story drawn from her own experiences, which includes, of course, Lola having her image stolen, which came from Mazzi having her Cam videos pirated and reposted without crediting her. The interactions with unhelpful police also come from her and other girls' experiences and being judged or hit on while seeking help from the authorities. She even stated in an interview that the scene in the film where a policeman asks Alice, "What is the weirdest thing you have ever had to do?" was asked not by police in her case, but by Hollywood executives when she was having meetings after writing the script and trying to get it produced. Mazzi also says in the same interview that making the audience root for a sex worker to return to sex work is based on the human connection developed through a screenplay and films that depict her way, her just the way that she is, produced within the narrative structure of the genre film like a thriller or a horror film. One of the best things about the horror genre is that it can be used to push boundaries, not just the obvious ones relating to taste and what you can get away with showing on screen, but also where a story might go. And I think that's an aspect of horror films that I've always rather liked. Like I said earlier, here we have a film from 2018 presenting many aspects of the AI that we are now worrying about internationally today in 2023. Now, there's a really nice quote from Vice magazine, an interview with Vice Online magazine, whatever you call it, with Iza Mazzi that it's worth reading here. So I'm going to read you the whole thing. Okay, here we go. "It's absolutely important to the film to be, if not sex positive, at least neutral. I think that a lot of horror likes to have a morality to it. And the classic story of the sex worker in media is innocent woman corrupted by a dark industry and she fights her way out of it. And I find that narrative incredibly problematic and incredibly damaging. It completely takes away a woman's agency to choose. You never see just the normal sex worker who has made a conscious choice to engage in the industry and who views it as their business. And that's actually the majority of sex workers that I know. It was very deliberate to subvert that expectation that we see, especially in genre." Okay, the quote goes on. "Similarly, I wanted to subvert the expectations of women in genre because, especially in horror, we're so used to seeing female characters make decisions that I, as a woman, would never make. As a woman, when I hear a noise in my basement, I absolutely do not go into my basement alone and unarmed and without a light. The other thing was important for me to have Alice make her smart choices. She does call the police. She does seek help. She does try to investigate what's going on. She has a taser when she goes to this, that she's referring to a scene where she goes to meet a customer. Yes, she goes to meet one of her male clients, but she protects herself. She brings a weapon with her." Okay, that's the end of the quote. Mazzi also talks about the discomfort of seeing sex workers used as the butt of jokes, even when comedies often include them dying as part of the gag. This lack of dignity oversteps a mark that other types of workers, she uses the example of, say, a software engineer, are not subjected to in most films. This interview contains some really important stuff that she highlights about the working conditions cam girls fight against. Like many adult performers who get their images and videos ripped off and never credited to them, then placed on corporate sites like Pornhub, with her making absolutely nothing out of it. Both women in these two films are working against the system too. At one point, we see Cassidy touring her strip club trying to get punters interested in a private dance from her, but none of them are going for it. This is insinuated as being specifically about her age. Her power is dwindling over time. Alice's is because of a system built to use and exclude her as soon as they've got what they need from her. Very interesting to think about some of the things that have been said during the negotiations relating to not just the writers' strike that's going on in Hollywood, but also the actors' strike that's just beginning. Because, of course, one of the examples I had there was cloning the images of background artists so that they could be used again, therefore never having to, at a certain point, not having to employ people anymore, and you could just use their images so they're out of work. Neither of these films dehumanizes their sex worker characters. They are not disposable, but they're vital parts of the plot in both instances. With both The Wrestler and Cam, what we see is that working class women and even sex workers can be central characters in a film without cliche or judgment. And while this seems like a small thing, I think it represents a form of progression that actually matters. Hopefully we can challenge pop culture to provide better representation like this, because frankly, it does not take much effort. If you can't actually avoid cliche, then maybe you shouldn't bother being a filmmaker. So there you go. That's episode one of Working Class Cinema. That's The Wrestler and Cam. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Be sure to check out my other one, which is Marks at Play, which I record with Jamie Woodcock, and the radio show that I'm often on, which is called All the Rage on Trax FM. That's www.traxfm.org. That is, of course, Trax, T-R-A-X. Also, please subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you're listening to this and share it with everybody that you know. In the meantime, if you wish to get in contact with me to talk about any of these films or to suggest anything for the podcast. So I'm not actually got anything set up on the socials for this yet. As I say, it's only the first episode, so we'll see where we go with that. But in the meantime, you can get me at the Trax FM Twitter page or the Trax FM Facebook page. That's Trax. Also All the Rage. I actually have an All the Rage Twitter page too, which is at ATRT. That's all capitals. RAXFM. But you'll find me, all right? You know, if you've got All the Rage, you've got Trax FM, you've got all you need, okay? And I'll set something up for this in the future. So anyway, thanks for listening, folks. I hope you enjoyed this. And I'll see you again soon for another episode of Working Class Cinema.